This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of The Jane Austen Podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome, and thanks for listening to the latest episode of Borders Blatherings, the podcast where Mary Craig and I get together and have a chat about the curious, shadowy, and often magical history of the Scottish Borderlands. Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm good. We're sitting in a very upmarket recording studio.
We are indeed. We're just watching the rain going past the windows.
Watching the rain, yeah. Mm-hmm. And on that thought, the professionalism, do you ever wish sometime that we scripted these podcast episodes a little bit more rather than me throw a topic at you, ask you some questions, and get you to do most of the heavy lifting, as it were? Does that ever cross your mind?
Well, it has crossed my mind in that a few of my friends, so-called friends, have been recently shouting at me on social media that I talk too much and I should let you get a word in edgeways. So perhaps if we scripted it, it might be a more even-handed podcast. But you know I'd go off script anyway, so it wouldn't work.
Me too.
Absolutely wouldn't work.
And I would be very uncomfortable sitting with a piece of paper and reading out.
Yes, that always actually puts me off my flow. Yeah.
I like the idea of just throwing a topic at you.
And we'll see where we go with it.
And along with the people listening, I'm learning as I go along. You're the archivist, historian, and I learn from you.
Well, so, I do as well. As I'm talking, I can hear, you know, I'm thinking, oh, actually that just goes in with that, and yeah, that makes sense there. So sometimes talking it through, discussing it, it's like anything in history. If you talk it through and you debate it, you come to a slightly changed position or a very changed position on elements.
Exactly the point. So good. So let's make an agreement now that we don't script any of this and we just do what we've been doing. So I guess that said, let me take you through step by step what I'm thinking we talk about today. And I'll try and do this in fewer than 39 steps.
Yay.
That's your first clue.
That's your first clue.
So, to do some talking. In the last few episodes of the podcast, we've been rough wooing with Henry VIII.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about the impact of the Great War on this part of the world. So I thought, let's go for something a little bit lighter today, just to change the mood a little bit. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So what I've come up with is, and I'll explain to you, something linked to the Business English work that I'm doing with different students at the German companies, VW and PowerCo and Siemens and so on. A few weeks ago, I was doing some work with a group on narrative grammar, narrative tenses.
Mm-hmm.
Telling a very engaging story. Or even a joke in the correct circumstances. I go on to them about that being an important business skill, you know, on your business travels, you know, socializing and so on. And a few days ago, I was preparing material for the next tutorial with the same group.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was writing was material on evaluating and comparing options, projects, proposals, and so on. And I thought, let's link that back to the narratives and storytelling I had done previously.
Okay.
And I decided that I would use two writers in preparation for that material.
Mm-hmm.
One, Arthur Conan Doyle, and one, John Buchan. And at that point, I realized that I know a lot more about Arthur Conan Doyle than I do about John Buchan.
Okay.
So I'd started with some material like, I'm looking at things like similarity and difference by the same token, likewise, or in contrast, on the other hand. So introducing that functional language to the students. So I was sitting at my Word document and I came up with, Arthur Conan Doyle often felt that the character Sherlock Holmes was to become a bit of an albatross round his neck, deflecting from his other works. Then I realised, is it in contrast, John Buchan? Or similarly, John Buchan? Because Buchan is famous for the 39 steps.
Indeed, with the hero Richard Haney.
And Hitchcock started that, but there have been many remakes of that movie, the 39 steps. And I thought, that's today's topic with Mary, because I don't know enough about John Buchan. What I do know is that Buchan and his family had a very strong connection with the Scottish borders and the Tweed Valley.
Absolutely.
I know there is a John Buchan Museum in Peebles, in the Scottish borders. But beyond that, there's not a lot I do know. And I don't know if Buchan suffered from the fame of the 39 steps and it cast a shadow on his other work. I have in the past come across literary critics who have argued that the 39 steps, which he's very famous for, was one of his lesser works. So I thought, that's today's topic. John Buchan, his life, his work, and his relationship with this part of the world. How do you feel about that?
We could be here for days. There is so much about John Buchan's life. There is so much. And you were saying earlier that this was not going to be as heavy a topic as the Great War or the Great Wooing.
And I was wrong.
You were wrong. This is going to be really, jinx. Where to begin? Let's start with the basics. He was born in 1875 in Perthshire.
In Perthshire, yeah.
His father was a Free Kirk minister.
Uh-huh.
His mother, and he had a couple of brothers. The family were in Perth, then they moved to Glasgow. But his maternal grandmother was from the borders, and he spent every single school holiday in the borders and loved it. It was a place of adventure and excitement and fun and laughter as a child, and of rejuvenation when he was an adult, even if he didn't get there.
Oh, here's the material. Similarly, or by the same token, Sir Walter Scott spent much of his childhood in the Scottish border. So that
there
impact.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he was practically running wild, you know, so he's the son of the manse sort of type thing, and a very strict upbringing, and his mother sort of inculcated him with a great sense of sin, and sin was inside. And then he comes down to borders, him and his brother Alistair run about playing cowboys and Indians as children did at that time. Running wild and, you know, barefoot and up and down trees and guddling for trout and all these sorts of things. So he has a sort of averagey lower middle class type upbringing. But he's a very, very bright boy, and he wins a scholarship. Once they move to Glasgow, he wins a scholarship to Hutchie Grammar.
Hutchie Boys, as it was when I was
in Glasgow. So he wins a scholarship to Hutchie Grammar.
Yeah.
And then he wins a scholarship to go to Glasgow University. Now, while he's at Glasgow University, he doesn't have a lot of money because his folks don't have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote, had published, and were successful with 5 books while he was an undergraduate at Glasgow. This is a great talent for him. So he is at Glasgow University, and then he wins yet another scholarship to go to Oxford. I think it was Brasenose College in Oxford.
Okay, yeah.
And this is where people who were very intelligent, but from the lower orders, as it would be, you went to Oxford or Cambridge to get polish.
Mm-hmm.
To get the rough edges knocked off if you wanted to become part of the establishment. And he ends up with a group of friends, people like Hilaire Belloc, the poet. I've forgotten his first name, the son of Asquith, the Prime Minister's son. You know, people like this. And again, he's having to write to earn a living because his parents can't afford this. The scholarship fees are paid.
Mm-hmm.
So he graduates with all honours. and then isn't quite sure what to do. And he goes out to South Africa. And at that time, it was the tail end of the Boer War. Now, the Boer War was, like all wars, pretty horrific. But what was most horrific about it was the fact that we invented concentration camps.
Indeed we did. Yeah.
And we concentrated the Boer women and children in there, sanitation failed, and thousands died horrifically. And John Buchan saw that. He was also very aware of the fact that there were British people running South Africa, there were Boer people who didn't want us there, and there was the local African population that absolutely didn't want us there, thank you very much. But he was a man of empire.
Yeah,
he was a man who thought that the British Empire was a good thing, but that the reason it went wrong was not the fault of the local indigenous population. It was our fault that we hadn't done it properly, that we hadn't behaved like gentlemen, that we hadn't kept to the rules. And that, to him, was where there were problems. And he could see there were sort of cracks, if you like, because Britain's tipping over. We're not quite in the, you know, we're falling out of sort of the first Premier Division, if you like to put a football analogy in. But he had a great love of South Africa. A great love of South Africa. One of his earliest books, I think it was one of his first books, was actually called Prester John.
Yeah, I remember that
and
from school. Yeah,
it's about a black African who leads an uprising. And the book, in a way, does look forward to Africans ruling themselves. I mean, he's quite a sympathetic character in there. So it's interesting that he did that. But he had a great love of South Africa. So after the Boer War, he's not quite sure what he's going to do. He's writing, he's working as a correspondent for the Times, war correspondent for the Times. And then he comes back to Scotland and he's writing. But the thing was that he wasn't quite sure what direction he wanted to take in life. His mum had wanted him to go into the Kirk. His mothers always do.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Be a doctor or a minister, that's what you get told, or sometimes a lawyer. But he wasn't sure that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a writer, but he also wanted to do his duty, and he wasn't quite sure. And what started to happen was, round about that period, there were exciting adventure books being written. So a boy's daring do, boy's adventures.
Yeah, yeah.
But he writes the first sort of spy book. Now, the first spy book you could see would be The Riddle of the Sands, which was about two men going on a boating holiday and discovering a German plot. And I can't remember the author's name. My apologies to that author. Buchan picks up on that and he develops it. He absolutely develops it. And he starts to write The 39 Steps. Now, he wrote The 39 Steps when he was actually quite ill. He spent 3 months in bed with a horrific duodenal ulcer that sort of plagued him all of his life. He was never a well man. He was never a well man. And so he writes The 39 Steps, which is, of course, Richard Hannay and spies and chasing about and, you know, all these sorts of things. It's quite funny. The book is quite interesting. So Richard Hannay, for those that don't know, Richard Hannay's character stumbles across a plot to murder the Greek Prime Minister. The person who's told him this is then found murdered in Richard Hannay's flat, so Richard Hannay has to flee. He flees out of London and he goes where? The Borders countryside. And he is chased through the Borders countryside.
Yep.
And you get to the end and the baddies are caught and it's wonderful. And that's the sort of daring do adventure top bit of that book. But actually what it's about human weakness and human evil and the cracks in society and how thin the veneer of civilization is. And that's what Buchan is about. Buchan is writing about the fact that a Lord of the Flies, give us a chance and we will revert back to being savages very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And that runs right through all of his writings.
So there's a conflict there in the sense you have this young lad who's roaming about the Scottish borders a lot of the time, great sense of adventure, playing cowboys and Indians and so on. Then he goes to Oxford, and the rough edges are knocked off him. The establishment, the status quo is presented to him.
Yes.
And that's been a conflict for him
for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
The Great War breaks out, and he instantly tries to join up. And they say, no, you're not well enough, go away. And so he gets really angry about this and he's not quite sure what to do and he wants to be a war correspondent. So he goes out to the front. Lord Haig gets a hold of him and has him in as an intelligence officer because realises he knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ministry of War at home bring him in to do home propaganda. Now,
propaganda? You mean the information directorate?
No, it was propaganda. And again, Buchan knows that what he's doing is, if you like, a necessary evil.
Yes.
You can't have everybody in Britain being told about how many thousands of men are dying in the Somme because morale would collapse.
Yeah.
So he understands that it's a necessary evil, but he also understands that by doing that, you are undermining confidence in reporting. You're undermining confidence in the government.
Yeah.
You're undermining confidence in the papers because people will know the reality. Eventually that will come out.
Mm.
And he always worried about that. It's the, again, it's these cracks.
Yeah.
You're doing a bad thing for the greater good, but where do you stop doing the bad things for the greater good?
So interesting. Yeah.
The other problem with the Great War was that his brother Alistair is killed and three or four of his close friends are killed. Mm. And by the end of the war, he's exhausted. He's emotionally exhausted. And he turns away from fiction. And for the next several years, all he writes are histories of the Great War, histories of Great War battles.
Sorry to interrupt, but does he get into poetry at all? Because I've seen him sometimes, Buchan, listed as a journalist, a correspondent, and a poet.
He wrote novels, he wrote non-fiction, he wrote poetry, he wrote essays, he wrote journalism, he wrote biographies, you name it, he wrote it.
Right, because I'm not aware of his name when it comes to people like Sassoon and Wilfred Owen and so on. I didn't come across Buchan as a poet.
It wasn't war poetry in that sense.
Okay.
It was much more dreamy poetry, if you like.
Ah.
Poetry about what life could be.
Could be,
rather than what
there
it actually
you are.
Was.
There's that contradiction.
Again, that contradiction
in
terms.
Yeah.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
So he marries into the aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
His wife is called Susan. I hope that's the right name. she's related to the Duke of Westminster, so he's married into the aristocracy,
yeah.
And he's got a son and a daughter. And everything's lovely and he's relaxing and he's trying to recover from the fact that he's lost all these close friends. He's,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he's still a young man. He's seen the horrors of the Boer War. He's now there's the horrors of the Great War.
Yeah.
And everything's sort of calming down. And then he thinks, actually, my sense of duty, my sense of empire. And so he goes back and he stands as an MP and he's elected as an MP for the Scottish universities. He wanted high office, he wanted to be in the government, but he never got into the government because he wasn't a good party man. He was a Conservative, but he had friends in the Labour Party, and friends in the Liberals, you know.
So oh, how dare he.
How dare he. But he continues to write. And it's in his writing, I mean, everybody knows about the 39 steps, but Richard Hannay and Leitham and these other characters he develops. And you can see how Buchan is growing in stature himself. He went from being a Scot in Scotland to being a Scot in England. So he's a bit of an outsider. He went from being lower middle class to having all these upper class friends.
To being part of the aristocracy,
In the Conservative Party, but he's not in government. He's always on the edge. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at these cracks in civilization. And he's, in his writing, he's saying things like, some things are not what they appear to be. Spies are not who they appear to be, mm-hmm. because they're supposed to be, you know, the policeman in the police uniform might not be a policeman. And the person that you think is good might turn out to be bad. And it's quite prescient in that if you think of all of the very major spies we have ever had in Britain, Philby, Maclean, Burgess, Blunt, they're all upper class. They're all Oxford and Cambridge. Mm-hmm. It's not your working class Jimmy at the end of the road that's going to betray the country. It's these guys. And yet these are the guys that we look up to. These are the chaps that went to the right school and they went to the right university. They're in the right clubs and they have the right accent. And we could name a few today that I wouldn't trust as far as I could throw them. And we have this perception of civilization and they like artworks and they go to the opera and all these sorts of things. Meanwhile, they're stabbing you in the back. They are traitors. And that is writ through all of his writing, both the fiction and the non-fiction. He doesn't get into high office in Britain, but he actually becomes governor of Canada.
He's in Canada for a while. And there, in a sense, he's with the different provinces. You have the French-speaking Quebec. He's trying to pull people together. He's trying to paper over the cracks, as it were. Fairly humane approach to the job.
But again, he's an outsider. He's a Scot in Canada. He's not Canadian.
It's interesting you say that because he holds a lot of public office.
Yes.
But he's always on the outside.
He's still an outsider because he's part of the British establishment, which is all Lord this and Lord that.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's the son of the manse. He's in Canada, but he's not Canadian. He's talking to French Canadians and he's not French. Yeah. He's talking to native Canadians and he's not a native Canadian. Mm-hmm. So again, he's on the edge. And he's quite seriously ill at this point. And I mean, his last book, funnily enough, I mean, Richard Hannay, I think, is in 5 or 6 of his novels, but so's a character called John Leithan. And in his last book, he has Leithan, who is dying of tuberculosis, being sent up into the wilderness of Canada to find somebody. And it's a man who is physically ill, physically exhausted, physically extremely unwell and debilitated, still having to do this thing, still having to do his duty, mm-hmm. as Buchan himself was doing his duty as governor of Canada. And I mean, he died in office. He died in office. But his legacy is the fact that you can read the books as daring do and excitement, or you can read them for what they are, an exploration of, is empire good? Mm-hmm. What do we mean by civilization? Yeah. Who's in charge? Who sets the rules? Who can you trust? The enemy within. The danger that is in the familiar. It's very interesting that in a lot of his novels and in his non-fiction writing, he refers back to the Scottish borders. He talks about being at one with the border hills, that was as close to home as you could get. Everyone's equal in nature. If a tree falls on you, it doesn't matter if you've tuppence to your name or £1 million. If a tree falls on you, it falls on you. If you fall into a stream, you're going to get wet, no matter who you are.
So there's comfort in the borders. I'm thinking, as you're speaking, I'm thinking of the rolling hills of the borders.
Yes.
They're not as dramatic as the highlands.
No.
They're not as dramatic as the Alps.
No.
There's a warm gentility.
Yes, and the way the border hills sort of fold in on each other, yeah, and then all of a sudden you come across a single house in the middle of nowhere with smoke coming out the chimney, and it looks so homely. Mm-hmm. It is nature, but it's safe nature.
Uh-huh.
It's nurturing nature. Yeah. It's comforting nature, and it's interesting that he refers back to that. He often refers to South Africa as well. He had a great love of the South African countryside.
Yeah, yeah.
Cities, he wasn't, and he spent so much time in cities, but he doesn't like cities. Cities are where you're not quite sure what you're seeing, and there's a traitor around every corner, and there's, I mean, if you're on a Borders Hill, you can see for miles. You can see where there is danger.
Yeah, yeah.
You're walking down the Oxford Street in London, or Circuit Hall Street in Glasgow, or the Bois de Boulogne in Paris. There could be a traitor standing right behind you, and you don't know because he looks like a friend. The danger within, the danger in familiarity.
Yeah, that begins to make a lot of sense, because you have that comforting feel down here. And he's put in interesting positions, because being an outsider, you said he's in Canada, but he's not Canadian. He's in South Africa. But maybe there's great value in having that perspective on the world. Maybe that is a good character developer, in a sense, you know, to be in that position rather than to just belong to the aristocracy or the powerful classes. He's come from somewhere else, and he's looking through a different mirror, in a sense, at what's going on.
Yes,
you know, which gives him a.
And I think also it goes back to his childhood with his mother giving him this great sense of sin that was internal.
Yeah.
Because up until he starts writing these spy novels, you know, the baddie always wears a black hat and has a moustache.
Yeah.
You know, you know, it's the Black Knight. We know who the good guys are, and we know who the bad guys are.
Yeah.
And he comes along and says, well, no, you can't see it externally. It's internal.
Yeah.
There are some people who are wicked. There are some people who are evil. And, you know, as Hanny develops, so Buchan develops, and as Buchan develops, so Hanny develops. I mean, the 39 steps, he sort of wrote, he was ill, as I say, and he wrote to his friend, and he said to one of his friends, you know, you and I are always laughing about dime novels, and I've got none left. I'm going to write one. And he described the 39 steps as a dime novel. It's way, way above that. So he writes the 39 steps, and he was surprised himself at how financially successful it was. Not that he needed a huge amount of money, but, you know, he still made money. and when Hitchcock made the film, it was quite funny. He actually got invited, John Buchan, I'm confusing him with Richard Hanny here. John Buchan and his wife were just about to go to Canada. And Hitchcock said, you know, I've made the 39 steps, would you like to come along? And John Buchan's wife was furious with what Hitchcock had done to the book.
Oh, really?
There was a love interest had been chucked in there.
In the B&B,
And she was absolutely outraged with what he'd done. John Buchan actually looked at it and went, well, yeah, it's not quite my story, but actually I'm interested in what you've done. There's a fantastic photograph I'll see if we can find it and stick it on our website.
Right.
And it's a photograph of John Buchan and Hitchcock looking at each other completely distrustfully. It's really, really odd. You know, Hitchcock was a sort of quite a wee chubby chap.
Yes.
He almost looks like a goldfish. And John Buchan was thin and quite thin. And he looks like a heron. It's side on. It's the oddest looking photograph ever. But John Buchan understood what Hitchcock was doing. I mean, Hitchcock was the master of suspense.
Yeah.
And people say that. Well, I'm sorry, he might be the master of suspense in film. I say John Buchan's the master of suspense in literary forms. Because the first one, the 39 steps, Richard Hanny is in his house in London. His next door neighbour, whom he doesn't know is a spy, comes in and says, I've uncovered a plot to kill the Greek Prime Minister. It's all in my book. I need to go away and collate all my notes up. Can you help me out? Can you let me stay here? Richard Hanny says yes, goes away, comes back. And the other spy is lying dead, murdered on his floor.
Yeah.
Instantly, he's under suspicion.
Yeah.
And that being hunted and being the hunter for the whole of the book until the final denouement at the cliffs in the Kent coast.
It's classic Hitchcock in one sense, the movie, because you have the MacGuffin.
Yeah.
And then you have the innocent man who's just embroiled in this adventure, unwittingly, in a sense.
Yeah. Whereas with John Buchan, it was much more nuanced.
Yeah.
I mean, the character of Richard Hannay could have said, I don't know, he came in here with a book. That would have been the end of the book, obviously. But he came in here with his book of clues and I know nothing about it. Or he could have, you know, I don't know, gone to the early call of MI5, I think it was MO5 it was called, and reported all of this. Obviously, there wouldn't have been a story. But, you know, the character chose to pick that up and run with it because the character knew what his duty was.
This is back to the sense of duty.
Yes.
And there's a fairly modern parallel. One reflects back. I'm going back to similarly. But the late Queen.
Yes.
Was known for her sense of duty very much.
Yes.
But I wouldn't even know what brand of tea she drank.
I've
never heard an opinion.
Uh-huh.
And yet this morning on the radio, I hear that William, the soon-to-be king, has made a few statements about the Israeli-Gaza war. And I'm just wondering how things are changing now and whether William will be attacked.
Yes.
For having an opinion.
For having an opinion, yes. Well, I mean, John Buchan and his writings were very much of the time, but because he's talking about human weakness and human evil, it's there are still eternal truths in there. One of my favourite books that he wrote was The Witchwood, which is about, it's set in the 17th century in the Borders. There's a young minister and he is told by the minister in the next parish, an older minister, that one of his parishioners is a witch.
Is a witch, yeah.
He then has to do his duty. So does he do what the Kirk of Scotland at that time told him to do, which is hunt the woman down, have her investigated, have her strangled, have her burned? Or does he do the humane thing and go and speak to the woman and find out if she really is a witch? And it's that, and does he do, because if he's going to kill the woman, even if she's not a witch, is that doing a bad thing for the greater good?
It's the same things over and over.
And if you actually look at the writing that John Buchan did away from his fiction into his non-fiction, if you read his histories of the Great War, they are extremely detailed, meticulously detailed books of the Great War and the different battles. And the whole time it's this sense of duty. We started, he doesn't discuss the beginning of the war. He does not discuss why we went into the war. But once we're there, you've got to do your duty.
Yeah, yeah.
But he is aware of the deaths. He is aware of the horrific deaths and casualties that are being generated. And again, you know, greater good, a bad thing for the greater good. Thousands of men are dying. Thousands of men are being maimed, but for the greater good. And it's that balance between is the greater good worth it? By the time you've done all the bad things, has the good of the greater good gone? And what is your duty?
So
all of this, it's very humane, his histories of the Great War battles. He doesn't shy away from casualty numbers because this was written after the propaganda. He's not glossing over it. He's not saying it was a grand, glorious war. He's saying it was a war that we had to fight because we were told that soldiers follow orders. You might disagree with the order. You might think the order is completely awful. But once you're given that order, you do your duty. But he does question how far you can take that.
Okay, so let's enter the realms of hypothesis. For a few years, around the time of Remembrance, I chose to wear a white poppy instead of a red poppy. And I often got a lot of stick from people for doing that.
Yeah.
And was accused of being unpatriotic. My view was that mothers and fathers from many countries lost sons and daughters in war. Would Buchan, were he alive today, have worn a white poppy?
Now that's interesting. He has a book, and I can't remember the name of it, but Richard Hannay again is in there, and he has to go sort of undercover, as it were, and break up a pacifist group. And there is this scene where his controller is saying to him, you're going to have to go and listen to things that you fundamentally disagree with.
Disagree with, yeah.
You're going to have to listen to people standing and spitting on everything that you believe in, mm-hmm. and you're going to have to agree with them. And Hanny has to go in, the character has to go in, and he's, you know, he's literally having to agree with these pacifists and say it's wonderful and be against the war and against the government and all the rest of it. And the Hanny character is, he is an imperialist. He absolutely is. Yeah. But Buchan didn't even have to write that book. Why did he give that platform to pacifism at all? He could have had it as spies. He could have had German spies. Yeah. He could have had any nationality as spies. He could have had traitors in the British establishment. He could have had bank robbers that were making hay while everybody was away at the war. Mm-hmm. He chose to shine a spotlight.
Yep.
On pacifism.
Uh-huh.
And although he himself was no pacifist, through the book you can hear Hanny saying that he understands, he gets there and he disagrees absolutely 100% with everything.
But he's
to do
giving
with pacifism.
It room to breathe.
He's giving it room to breathe. And he's understanding why some of them are pacifists. Disagrees with them, thinks they should change their minds.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't have to do that at all. So I wonder if John Buchan possibly might not have worn a white poppy, we probably wouldn't have given you a hard time for doing so.
Aha, thank you. That makes sense to me, what you're saying. Now, Mary, before we end, because I don't know the answer to this. I'm going back to the Hitchcock movie. Where are the 39 stamps?
Well, in the book...
What was the inspiration for the 39 stamps?
In the book, the German spies go to the Kent Cliffs. They go to the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yeah.
And they're escaping down a staircase, mm-hmm. a secret staircase that has 39 steps. Mm-hmm. And that gets them to their submarines and they can go out. So that's it. It's the 39 steps. It's at the very end of the book.
But is there, I get that, but is there a location here in the Scottish borders that were the inspiration for?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Those steps.
I'm not sure, although I have heard people talk about things like the Grey Mare's Tail waterfall.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And that sort of drop where you could come down the back of it. I'm not sure if there's a definitive point in the borders that he was looking at.
Right.
But it is interesting that that Richard Hanny, you know, of all the places to try and hide, he chooses the Border Hills, in which he feels so familiar, in which he knows every crevice. He knows everywhere to go, and I believe that within every house that Buchan ever lived in, there were photographs, there were pictures, there were images of the Scottish borders. It was where his heart lay. And it rejuvenated him throughout his life, through all the ill health he had and the sorrow he had with losing his brother and all of his close friends.
Now, you're a published author.
Mm-hmm.
How do you rate Buchan as a storyteller? And do you agree with some of the literary critics I mentioned earlier who claim that The 39 Steps is one of his worst pieces of work?
I think his non-fiction work is amazing. The essays, the history, the biographies are fantastic. His fictional work, I think, is excellent as well. And I think it stands the test of time. Because I think there are some books that are written, for example, Sir Walter Scott. Sorry, Walter, but here we go.
I
think his books are unreadable today, whereas John Buchan's are not.
Yeah.
I think The 39 Steps is not his best book.
Mm.
I think The Dancing Floor or Witchwood are better.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he said himself he was writing a dime novel. You know, he said himself.
Yeah,
I mean, it's don't get me wrong; it's still an incredibly well written book.
Yeah.
It's a rattling good story. It hangs together. I know of other authors who would cut off their right hand to write something as good as The 39 Steps. It's just that John Buchan himself was such a good writer that I think The 39 Steps, although it's the one he's most famous for, is not his best book. But I would advise MG to go read it. It is a rattling good story.
That's what I was looking for,
Read underneath the story and realise what he's talking about and what he's actually saying in that book wrapped up in an adventure story, in a spy adventure.
So what, to summarize, what from what you've told me, we could put his achievements in this kind of order, that John Buchan was a biographer, a journalist, a historian, a statesperson, and a writer of fiction.
Absolutely.
That sums it up. Yeah.
And a good borders man.
And a good borders man. Excellent. Thank you very much, Mary. Great.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.